My name is Mary Alice. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. this makes me incredibly nervous. I have earned my living telling my story, and I don't have to be honest when I do that. But, you know, there's something about standing in front of this number of recovering women that kind of stretches me just a touch. So I really want to thank the committee for inviting me. I have been less than healthy in my recovery, and I've sat in rooms in this room and in the rooms down at St. Simon's and thought, I'd like to tell my story. You know? So here I am. Be careful what you think you'd like to do, because you too could end up at the podium. And I want to thank you guys. Thank you for being the women who helped me be the woman that I am today. I'm a very typical alcoholic, drug addict woman in that I didn't have much use for women. I didn't have many very good women role models in my life. And so coming into the fellowship and having to make friends with you guys was not easy. I carried my clipboard and took your inventory, you know, to see if there was anybody out there who looked like they could teach me something. And it took me a long time, and today I know I am who I am because of the women in my life, and I want to thank you for that. What I'd like to do is tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and I hope that I don't spend a whole lot of time telling you what it's like because you guys know what it's like. But for me, and I hate to say this because I grew up so average that we could have been on television, you know, Leave It to Beaver. I had a mom and a dad, and I lived in a city, and there were 10 houses to a block and 10 blocks to a mile, and I walked to school, and I didn't ever do without, and my parents drank. My parents still drink, but they don't drink the way I drink, and none of them grew up to shoot dope either, so, you know, it was just so incredibly average. So to me, that meant it was so incredibly boring. And, you know, there was just something, I never wanted to be average. I never wanted to be like anybody else, and I wasn't. You know, I'm one of those people who the family decided at a very early age that I could be the scapegoat because I was very good at it. And I really didn't get into much trouble till I could walk. And then I started running away about that time. You know, there were places to go, there were things to do, there were people to meet, and they were building fences. And they've been building fences around me as long as I can remember, and I've been tearing the fences down as long as I can remember. So, and then I didn't get into big trouble until I started school, you know, and I went to Catholic school, and so, you know, how that was. They wanted me to do their way, and I did. I wore my little blue skirt, I wore my little white blouse, and I showed up. And that was the best I could do for them, you know. And Sister Bernadine in the first grade, I think I did fairly okay in kindergarten, except that this is how I know I'm alcoholic. Every now and then I say, oh, I can't be alcoholic because look at me now. And so, but this is how I know I'm alcoholic. Mary Beth Bibb was the queen of the Mardi Gras parade, 1955, San Francis Cabrini grade school. I wanted to be queen of the Mardi Gras parade. So, you know, and I met Mary Beth Bibb as an adult and said, I hate you. She didn't have a clue. But you know, I mean, and so it was just some basic resentments that I started storing and keeping track of who had done me wrong. And Mary Beth Bibb goes high on that list. So, I have kind of forgiven her, you know, and I kind of forgave my mother because I thought that my mother should have gotten in there and made me queen. They drew names out of a hat. So, but they should have drawn my name. So my mother let me be the queen of hearts. And so, you know, she at least tried. And today I'm grateful for that. But I also learned to drink at a very early age. I grew up in New Orleans, and New Orleans is a drinking town. If you ever went there as a practicing person, you know it's a drinking town. I mean, they let you drink, let you throw up, let you do whatever you want to do. And nobody thinks anything of it. And that's how it was as a place to live. If you were tall enough to reach the bar, you were tall enough to drink. Well, as you can see, it took me a while to get tall enough to reach the bar, but I got there. And And my parents really believed that drinking was a very normal part of life, and so they taught me to drink at home. Because if I learned to drink at home, then I was not going to embarrass them when I went out in public. So I can't tell you when my first drink was. But I can tell you that very early in my unsupervised drinking, which was in 7th grade, 8th grade, that period of time, I was already very, very sick. I was already at that stage of addiction that nobody was going to make me do right. Negative attention was better than no attention at all. And I mastered negative attention. And it hurt. You know, it was a really, really hard place to be. So that when I learned to drink, it was a really, really easy place to be. And it was something that worked very nicely in my life. And I'm a firm believer that my acting out, that my drinking, that my progression in drug use saved my life. I really don't know that I could have kept putting one foot in front of the other. And being who I was, with that level of discomfort in my life. And so, and I had a lot of some early good times. When I was in the 9th grade, Sue Helbler and I were eating these snowballs, and these boys came along with some whiskey, and of course we drank their whiskey and our snowballs. And we went home and we brushed our teeth with Pearl shampoo and Blue Bubbles. You know, and we thought, well, you know, this isn't such a bad deal. It's really kind of okay. And I was probably starting to smoke cigarettes by that time on a fairly regular basis. I started smoking cigarettes as just a wee tot, you know, stolen from my mom, stolen from the maid, stolen from anybody who had them. And, you know, just trying to find better living through better chemistry. And so it was nicotine, it was booze, and by the time I was in high school, my father was transferred, and I really believe that this also saved my life. My father was transferred from New Orleans to Atlanta. Atlanta was a dry county, or the DeKalb County was dry, and you had to go into Fulton County to buy booze. And I went to a Catholic school, and but the advantage was is that the girls from St. Pius dated the boys from Georgia Tech. So it didn't take long for me to figure out who to be friends with. People who knew the boys at Georgia Tech, so I could go to fraternity parties, so I could drink, so I could be okay. And life kind of went on. By the time I was a senior in high school, it became very obvious that all the major events changing in my life were directly related to the men in my life. And of course, they weren't real men. We were in high school. They were young men, little boys. But this little boy knew about smoking pot. And he said, "Mary Alice, you don't drink worth a hoot. And so I think you need to try this." So I said, "Okay." And so I learned to smoke pot. Now, you know, in those days, that was in the late 60s, and those were the days when Reefer Madness, was shown on a pretty regular basis, and some people believe that you really would lose your mind if you smoked pot. I just knew that I'd be really cool, and, and they said that would lead to other drugs, and I knew that that would never happen to me, and that was the beginning of, that will never happen to me. So by the time I went to college, I went off to college, and again, just being a real upfront kind of woman, I made lots of friends. I knew the boys at the fraternity houses, and I knew who had drugs, and I knew who didn't have drugs, and I knew who were the right people for me to be seen with, and I played that game for a while. It was also the beginning of big protests. And I had to do those kind of things. And it was in college that I learned about pills, amphetamines to study, and I guess acid had become fairly popular by that time, and mescaline. And then I flunked out of college. I don't know how that happened. I majored in partying, and so therefore I had to go home for a quarter. And so my mother, you know how mothers are, she thought I needed a job. And so I thought, well, that was fairly ridiculous. But she was director of nursing at a hospital, and she said, "You have a job." And I said, "Thank you very much." And I showed up for work, and I worked as an EKG technician. Well, getting inside a hospital, I learned my way around the hospital, and I learned my way around the boys with pens. You know, the guys that you smile at and you say, "Oh, I have a headache, or I have a little menstrual cramp, could I have a little?" And they wrote me prescriptions for pain pills. And so that was just, you know, just one more thing. Again, smoking a little pot, drinking a little scotch, doing that kind of stuff, but, you know, I was never, ever going to do any real drugs. Then I had this old boyfriend. I was talking about him earlier today, but he was a whore, you know, just one of those worthless kind of boys that many of you have known. And I could not get rid of him. I could not get over him. It was an addiction that was just powerful. But he just could not stay home. So I couldn't leave him because we know me. I couldn't leave him. And so I said, I'm going to school. I'll leave town. I can't leave the relationship, but I can leave town. I can at least try to be better. And of course, I went to nursing school because nursing school was a very good place. I'd worked in the hospital, and I knew that nurses always had jobs. And I also knew that nurses were always fairly close to drugs, I guess. But it was an easy thing to do, and I went back to nursing school. And it was in nursing school that I met some people who started doing some different kind of drugs because I was working as the medicine nurse now. So I had the keys to the cabinet. Well, I never, ever was going to steal drugs. I knew that I would never, ever shoot dope. I knew that. So we had some morphine left over one day, and so my girlfriend said, let's just try it. We smoke pot, we grow our own mushrooms, It's cheap, it's easy, let's try it. Okay. So it was such a natural progression. I never, ever noticed the change. What I noticed was I functioned fairly okay. I went to school, I did things I needed to do, and the next thing I know, I'm shooting dope. I'll tell you the truth. The first time that I did IV narcotics, we went around to see if anybody noticed. Now, what were they going to notice, These girls have been shooting dope. There was, nothing hanging out of my arm, but that was just... So nobody noticed, so I figured it must be okay. That it made perfect sense to me. And so by that time, that old boy had finally gotten married to someone else. Thank you, Jesus. He married some other nurse. And I could move on to the next set of men who are going to change my life. So I graduated from nursing school. There was a little hoo-ha where I went off to Washington, did some other stuff, and, did some really looking like productive member of society kind of stuff. It was the great impersonation. So I get to Atlanta, I get a job, and, I am there. I am ready. I am Florence Nightingale. I am going to show nursing what nursing is all about. And so I guess it took me a couple of days to get into the narcotics cabinet. And it was a gradual. It was so gradual. And it was so easy. And it was so, what looked so normal. And, in those days, they had narcotics cabinets. Today, we have little computer machines. So we had keys. And I would forget, and I'd take the keys home with me. And they always called Manuel's Tavern before they called home. Because I worked 3 to 11. I went to Manuel's Tavern, and we closed Manuel's. And went down the street to Moe's and Joe's. And I drank a lot, and I ran with some wild folks. And we were young professionals in Atlanta. And we were having a fine time. And I was getting sicker and sicker. I was beginning to understand that there was something really, really wrong with me. Not just a little bit wrong, but there was something wrong. And it was starting that isolation. I started just kind of pulling in a little bit. And so I thought, the way to stop the bar scene would be to have a television. So I bought a television. And if you think that you can cure addiction by a television... maybe you can, maybe you can't. But Johnny Carson and I had a very meaningful relationship. So I decided that what was wrong with me is that I was working 3 to 11. I needed to work day shift. So a job came open in the emergency room, which was, such an awesome place to work. Go down there and save lives. So I went to the emergency room, and I started saving lives and stealing dope and looking around for boys. I was thinking, if I had the right man... Those boys in the bar weren't the right men. I needed a doctor. So it was July 1st, and the doctors came in. Bless their little hearts. Here they are, fresh out of medical school. They've got on their little white coats, and here are the ER nurses lined up waiting. When I got sober, I could have given you a list of boys who had done me wrong. Well, I'm here to tell you that I should probably give you the list of the boys that I did wrong. I was never quite the victim I wanted you to think I was. So this old boy, bless his heart,
His name was Dave, and he was just as cute as he could be, and he wasn't really very smart. And he didn't have a chance. You know, it was like alcoholic woman sees man, look out, boy. So I really thought that if I could just get this guy to marry me, I would be okay. Well, that was fine until the OB-GYN resident showed up, and I fell in love with him, and so I was kind of seeing the two at one time when we were talking about this at dinner, you know, about how sometimes nurses really don't have very good reputations, and and there's a reason. So I was not like my most professional self. You know, I could kind of sneak off to the on-call room with, and just, you know, revitalize myself. So I'm getting into a lot of trouble in my head. I'm doing things that I know are not right, and I'm beginning to suspect that if that old boy Dave ever got a really good look at my arms, because by this time I was shooting a lot of dope. And I was shooting dope in the bathroom. And you know, there's nothing social about IV narcotics use in the bathroom, whether you're at home or at work. You know, I no longer could justify what I was doing. And then I was dating this little cocaine dealer because, you know, I needed him, you know, because he had cocaine. So I was beginning to see that I was in trouble. And I thought if I could quit shooting dope, I'd be okay. So I didn't need to quit drinking. I didn't need to quit smoking pot. I just needed to quit shooting dope. And then maybe I could start winding down on some of the boys. And I was going to be okay. So I took 3 days off, and I lied to everyone. I mean, I've been lying to everyone for a long time, but this was a uniform lie. I told everyone I was going someplace else, and I stayed home. And so I stayed home, and I hid my car, and I prayed to a God that I didn't know. I went over to Christ the King because I was raised Catholic. It was a weekday. If you need God, go to the biggest church you can find. So I went over to Christ the King, and I sat in the back, and I said, God, it's me, Mary Alice Giblin. And God said, yes, Mary Alice, what can I do for you? And I said, you know, I feel terrible, and I need help. I need to not do IV narcotics anymore. And God said, well, bless your heart, baby girl, I'll take care of that. So that was like on a Thursday. So I went to work on Friday, and I drove all the way to work, you know, just white-knuckling that steering wheel because I knew I was a changed woman. I knew that I was going to go to work and I wasn't going to do drugs anymore. Well, I did in the first 15 minutes. And, you know, so I've got this syringe full of dope, and I'm in the bathroom, and I put the needle in my arm, and I looked up, and I said, F you, God, if this is the best you can do, 15 minutes ain't going to cut it. And I have never been so frightened or so alone in my life, ever. Because that was the first time that I really, really knew that God didn't give a shit about me. Because I couldn't get better. Well, that was Friday. Then we went to Saturday, and I did the same thing. And on Sunday, I was in a hurry. I had a party to go to. And I went in just before I gave a report. I went into the bathroom, and I injected what was in the syringe. And I came out to give a report to the 3-11 nurse, and I had a seizure, an overdose seizure in the nurse's station. And they noticed. They said, something is wrong with Nurse Giblin. And the little spot where I just injected was, you know, they took my blood pressure to see if there was something wrong. And for some reason they went to the narcotics book. And they admitted me, and they admitted me to a neurosurgeon or neurology or one of those guys. And they worked me up for seizure disorders, and they called the narcotics agents. And the narcotics agents came, and I worked the first 3 steps sitting in that hospital bed. I admitted that I was powerless, that my life was unmanageable, and I turned my will and my life over to the care of those narcotics agents. And, you know, they said, they were really amazing. I was so sick, and I was so scared that I didn't care what I told them, because they promised to help me. And they did. They told me about this guy named Doug Talbot. And they said that this guy had this treatment center out in Smyrna, Georgia. Well, who would go to Smyrna? But I said, okay, Smyrna, Georgia. And they said, he takes care of doctors, but we don't know what he does with nurses. Well, We know what he does with nurses. And so I just, you know, I called him up. I said, hey, listen, I'm a nurse. I need help. And they said, come on over. So the neurologist came in, and I said, listen, I think that seizure was a little Demerol related. And he said, yeah, you've been stealing a lot of Demerol. And so I said, I'm going off to treatment. He said, sure, go ahead. So I went out to Ridgeview, and I met with this guy named Phil Wilson. And Philip, God bless Philip. He is an angel of mercy, and he was fairly new in the field. And so we do this little interview, Philip, Shelley Lautenschlager, and myself. And I'm sitting there just very prim and proper, and, you know, and I've got black eyes because, you know, I hit my head and it bled, and I looked like a drowned rat. I weighed about 92 pounds, and I was still 5 feet tall then. And so, you know, I was not the cutest girl in town. So I show up, and they say, and so they run through these questions. You know, have you ever done this drug? Have you ever done that drug? Have you ever done? Yeah, yeah. And I'm going, yeah, I do that. And they said, well, after about an hour of this, and you know, and I'm telling them how miserable I am and how lonely and da-da. And they said, well, we think you're an alcoholic and a drug addict, and you need to stay here for treatment. I said, excuse me, but I don't think so. And he said, what do you don't think? I said, I'm not an alcoholic and a drug addict. He said, well, then why are you here? I said, because I can't quit shooting dope. And he said, that is what we call an addict. I went, duh. So I knew he wasn't right. You know, I knew that he was confused, but I said, well, I'm going to go home and think about it. He said, the sheriff's here. I said, you know, this is a nice place. So I may not have been the healthiest woman on the planet, but I was not stupid. So I stayed, and I met some just charming people. And after about 3 days, Dr. Wilson came to see me, and he said, Mary Alice, how are you? I said, well, you know, I'd be fine if I could have something to eat. And he said, I can't find my way to the cafeteria. He said, Mary Alice, you've eaten 3 meals a day and snacks. I didn't remember. You know, it was like, I did that? So, you know, I was incorporating myself on the unit. People were leading me around and telling me where to go and what to do. And so my friends came. My girlfriends called my parents, and they said, I had these two, you know, just incredible women in my life who are still in my life. And so they called my parents, and they told my parents, you know, that I had this little problem and I'd gone to treatment. And so I told my friends that I thought that I needed to stay there all weekend. That if I had 3 days of treatment, that this would be really nice, and then I was going to join the sporting club. Because if I played racquetball 3 days a week, then I would be okay. Play, you know, 3 days of treatment, 3 days of racquetball, I'd be all right. And they didn't think so. And, you know, that was this was May 1980, okay? I'm 29 years old, May 1980, never been married, just to keep you up to where I am. And and Dave, the orthopedic surgeon, he came out for a couple of sessions, but he really didn't want much of this, and so I didn't blame him. But I showed him my 30-day chip when I got it. I was wearing it in my eye. And so they thought, in those days, nurses were doing 30 days of treatment. And then, you know, who knows, maybe they were going to some halfway houses, but they weren't doing really much with nurses. But then they met me, and they said, Mary Alice, we think that you could do like the doctors do, and you too could do 4 months of treatment. Well, actually, it took me 8 months. But, you know, I tried hard. I worked. I mean, I caught on to the fact that I didn't have to feel bad quickly. I loved AA. They said, Mary Alice, get on the bus. And I'd say, yes. And I'd get on the bus because they were going to Kroger's when they got finished at the meeting. Well, I didn't really care anything about going to AA, but I loved going to Kroger's. So, it was good, like, you know, reinforcement, you know. Get out of the treatment center, go to Kroger's. And so they took me to AA, they took me to NA, they took me, who knows where they took me, but they always took me to Kroger's. So I can't go to Kroger's today without being grateful. You know, it's just the places that we find what we need. So I start treatment. And fortunately or unfortunately, Doug loved me. because Doug saw a lot of me in him. Well, now, I had a few little legal problems. You know, they were like felony charges, theft by taking, forgery, and something else. Anyway, it added up to about 60 years in a federal pen. And when I went to AA, I told him I was an honest woman. And I believed it. You know, I mean, that those other charges, they didn't actually have anything to do with honesty. They just had to do with those minor details. So I eventually went to court, and I explained to the judge, because by this time I was several months sober, why they let me out on my own. Well, they didn't. They sent somebody else with me, you know, somebody from the treatment center. And I explained to the judge that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and it was my disease that stole those drugs. So the judge sentenced me and the disease. And so I got, you know, legal probation, and I got a giant fine, and I, you know, I mean, I really feel like I kind of bellied up to the bar and faced the legal system to the best of my ability and to the best of what they asked me to do. And so that was maybe the beginning that maybe I had really done some not so good things. So by this time, I'm pretty comfortable going to NA meetings, and I'm real comfortable in AA meetings. And for me, AA is what worked. There was something about the way the people in AA looked, and the way they talked, and the way they laughed, and the way they didn't use the F word quite as much as I did, that appealed to me. You know, there was, I wanted, so I went out and bought a pair of khakis and a pair of loafers, and I've worn khakis and loafers ever since. I'm the biggest nerd God ever made. You know, I mean, most people don't think IV narcotics addict, nerd, but here I am. So I started recovering, and I started doing the very best I could do. And I had license problems, and I couldn't administer controlled substance for 5 years, which today I know saved my life. And so if you can't administer controlled substance, work for the treatment center. So 2 years sober. I worked for Red Cross, and that was a great job for an IV drug addict. Oh, got a vein? Let me hit it. And so I didn't put that on my resume, but I wanted to. Can find veins where there are none. So I worked for Red Cross, and the only thing I stole from Red Cross were cookies. And I stole a lot of them. You know, I'm one of those women who gained 40 pounds the first 6 months she was sober, and, you know, that was it. You know, I ate everything that wasn't nailed down. So I did all the things that they told me to do. I changed my playmates and my playgrounds. I changed absolutely everything that I could. I couldn't change everything. You know, I did the very best that I could do. And I started going to meetings. But, you know, it was my first... I lived in the halfway house for, you know, up to that eighth month of recovery and didn't go any place by myself. I only went places with other recovering people. And they had these rules about, you know, he and she, and but they didn't apply to me. So it was just some boy addict mixed girl addict. And I never got caught, so I never got sent off to other treatment centers. But I really started looking at cleaning up just a little bit. So at 2 years sober, I went to work for Doug. And, you know, I'm really, really grateful that I had that opportunity. Because it required that I show up and dress up and start spreading some kind of message. By this time, I had learned that first year, I went to maybe an AA meeting a week, maybe two, hit an NA meeting occasionally, but went back for my aftercare and did that kind of stuff, was not a part of AA. So in my second year, I had moved out and I was living, you know, like almost independent living, and making some decisions for myself and deciding when I needed to go to meetings and when I didn't go to meetings. And I was living in the Buckhead area, and I was going to a clubhouse, and I would go in and I would share with people, you know, they call me and I'd say, And people come up and say, golly, that's really great. I really liked what you had to say. But I never made any friends. So one day I'm driving home from the meeting and I'm just weeping, you know, because I am so lonely. And knowing that there is something just not right. This is not really what I thought I was going to be, you know. But I hadn't made any friends. And, you know, God has been so good to me. I turned around, and by this time I'm not quite so angry with God. God and I are kind of teaming up again. With some direction. And so I went back to the Triangle Clubhouse, and I went into the kitchen. In those days, they used real cups, and I started washing cups. And people came up, and they said, hey, you know, I've seen you around here before. And I said, yeah, my name's Mary Alice. And so I started kind of just letting people kind of know who I was. I didn't have to just do the treatment center scene anymore. And that's about the time I went to work for Doug. And I'm really fortunate that all of that kind of went together. You know, it took 2 years for me to become a part of, and to make some friends, and to read the big book, and not rewrite. There was a book called As Bill Sees It, and I called it As Mary Alice Sees It, and started telling people exactly how to stay sober. Unfortunately, that's what happened to me when I went to work in the treatment field. I thought that because I had been hired, that I knew something. You know, they paid me. And so I was supposed to tell other people how to be sober, how to do it my way. Don't you want to grow up and be just like me? No? Slap the shit out of them and go on. So, you know, and I was running with the big boys. By this time, I was doing some national speaking. I was pretty much covering the North American continent, and I was telling people stuff that I really believed. It was stuff that I had heard other places. Did not have an original idea, but I could parrot anything. And I had this little style, you know, where I could get and I dressed up, you know, my suits and my pumps matched. My pumps matched my briefcase. I had little rosette ties. I mean, I was just one cool-looking babe. So, but, you know, my personal life was meh. And, you know, I could not get it together. But I really thought that because I had this great business card, all of these little alkettes following me, thinking that I knew what I was doing, going places and doing things, I really believed that. Well, some other people did too. And about, I guess I was about 5 years sober when I was hired away from Doug in the, whatever that program was I worked for, and went to work in Knoxville, and went into Knoxville to set up the Impaired Professional Program for the state of Tennessee. Well, when people asked me to do something like that, I thought that I could do it, and I could, because I'm an alcoholic woman, and if you give me a project or give me some direction, I can do anything. Anything. And so they said, do this, this, and this, and I went in and I did this, this, and this. I had no softness, I had no finesse, I had power, and I used it. And you know, I really didn't understand. I knew that there was a lot missing in my life, but I really didn't understand how I came across. I didn't understand that that I was doing things that I really didn't need to be doing. But God will do for me what I cannot do for myself, and I got fired. So now I'm about 6 years sober, and you know, man, Janet Johnson talked earlier this weekend about how she had asked God one time to just give her a nudge. You know, she didn't need a 2x4 every time. Well, I didn't need 2x4s. I needed dump trucks, steamrollers. So I got fired, and so the 2x4, you know, said, oh, maybe there is something wrong. You know, maybe I need to do something a little bit differently. Maybe there's some way that I can get a little bit better. Now, I don't mean to discredit where I was, you know, because I did my job. I shared my experience, strength, and hope, but I wasn't where I wanted to be personally. And so I went back to work as a staff nurse. And by this time, I think my license had been reinstated, and you know, life was really kind of going along pretty good. And so I went back to work, now I'm only working 40 hours a week, which is such a strange. I had to call somebody up and say, what do you do when you're home at 4:30 in the afternoon? You know, because my workaholism had stopped. You know, because I was a staff nurse. I didn't need to put in 60 hours a week. I didn't need to wear a suit. And that was quite an adjustment. And so things were moving along fairly well, but smoking cigarettes. And so the hospital went non-smoking. So I had to deal with non-smoking. So the way I dealt with non-smoking was I was smoking in the bathroom with Joyce and Gloria. And, you know, and they could fire me for that, you know, but I wanted to smoke cigarettes. So I'm in the bathroom smoking a cigarette, and I'm thinking there's something fairly familiar about this. You know, except there's three of us in there. It used to be just one person tooting dope, and now there are three people smoking cigarettes. Could there be a connection? So I went out, and I'm feeling kind of bad, and I'm thinking, gee whiz, I hope this doesn't mean I have to quit smoking. And I picked up the hospital newsletter, and there was this little tiny ad for the quit smoking class. Well, you know, when I was working at Ridgeview, I worked with a guy named Tom Butcher. Excellent therapist. I mean, just a real talented man, and just a great human being. And he would say things to me like, if you want to broaden the parameters of your recovery, quit smoking. And I'd go, I'd mutter it, you know? I'd mutter it for days. I didn't know what the hell the dude was talking about. But all of a sudden, here I am, quitting smoking. Now, I had done a written first step. I had done a written second step. I had seen the steps working in my life. I had done four steps on personal relationships, on professional relationships. I had done four steps on anything I could think of, because I wanted to get better. Well, here I am, about 7 years sober, and I'm quitting smoking. Well, let me tell you, I didn't know anything about working the steps till I quit smoking. And it sent me to new levels of growth. I mean, I got up there on the edge, and I thought, I don't know if I can do this. But I got a little bit better and a little bit better. But I had to go back and work all 12 steps in order one more time. And it was really a very, very frightening place to be. One of the things that I am truly most grateful for, because I now understand broadening the parameters of my recovery. And for those of you who have not yet thought about broadening the parameters of your recovery, this is a time that I say, you know, try it. I tried it many times before I was successful, but hey, it's what I grew by leaps and bounds. And it softened me. It softened me because it made me very human, and it made me have to reach out to other people. So I'm kind of moving along, and it's about time for me to go back to work in the emergency room, and I go back to work in the emergency room, and you know, I've seen some boys over here, and I've seen some boys over there, but I'm thinking, it's time, I need, you know, like one of those real men. So I say, hey God, it's me, I need a date. And if I could have one fairly soon, I'd appreciate it. I said, okay. So I went to work the next day, and this woman said, this guy is a friend of my husband's, and he just broke up with his girlfriend. He needs a date. Will you call him? I went, yeah. So, you know, it's that kind. It was those kind of things. So I called this boy, and we had a date, and oh, man, we had the best time, and it was just, everything was just perfect. He was a banker. I love bankers. So, you know, I mean, it was, things were kind of going, and that, but it didn't turn into like I didn't get married, you know? I mean, I asked God for a date. All of a sudden, I've got my wedding veil on, and, you know, and I missed something in between, and, and I said something to a therapist I was working with, and they said, you asked for a date. You didn't ask for a relationship. You didn't ask for a marriage. You asked for a date. You got a date. Be grateful that you had the date. And I said, oh, okay. So, but you know, it was those kind of things. Every single time something came up in my recovery, I had the money to meet the responsibility. I had the strength. I had the stamina. I had the people around me. And so, you know, there would be these, you know, kind of things. And that built my faith. It wasn't the stuff that I did every single day. You know, the 89 million meetings I sat in. The people who I sat next to who had just relapsed and were still puking their guts out. You know, it wasn't that kind of stuff. It wasn't all of those nights at the Oxford bookstore solving the problems of the world with other alcoholics that I saw building my faith. It was me asking God for a date, and God saying, okay, you can have a date. So by this time, you know, I'm kind of rocking along, and I'd be sitting in a meeting starting to think, you know, I'm fairly sober. I'm pretty close to a spiritual giant. I got this stuff licked. Quit smoking, did this, did that. And somebody would say, I've been sober like 27 days, and I've been sober 10 years before I drank. I mean, I'd run over and I'd get out my clipboard, start asking questions. What happened to you? Why did this happen to you? And so it was that kind of stuff that kept sending me back you know, and keeping me, you know, really fairly well in touch with what I thought was a program. So I'm about 9 years sober, I guess. And I'm thinking that, you know, there's got to be more to life. So I'm thinking, all right, you're 38 years old. You've never been married. You ain't got much money. You better figure out a way you're going to support yourself the rest of your life. So I said, well, I think I'll go to school, and I'll teach nursing. So I could go to work for Emory University, and so I started wheeling and dealing. And so I'm getting ready to go to school. And I've gotten a job at Crawford Long, and Emory's going to pay my tuition, and everything's just great. And my sister calls me up, and she says, it's my birthday, and, you know, it's the neighborhood birthday party. I want you to come. It's a covered dish. Well, you know, she lives in Little Five Points. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Atlanta, it's the granola land, you know? I mean, they're... more PhDs per capita, and they earn their living by mowing grass. And so, but they're earthbound people. And my sister is a lovely woman, and she has, for years, did not have a job. You know, she did a little temp here, a little temp there, bartered here, bartered there. But, you know, so obviously it was, I couldn't bring a hamburger. So I made this really nice vegetarian soup, and I go off. And just before I leave, she says, she calls me up and she says, a friend of mine just moved north of you. Will you give him a ride home? He doesn't drive. I said, yeah. Because, you know, I'm a spiritual giant. And so that's why, yeah, I'll give him a ride home. And I'm thinking, he probably doesn't drive because he's anti-Exxon. You know, it was around the spill time. So I go to my sister's just because, you know, I'm sober and I'm spiritual. And I'm there. And I'm standing there with my vegetarian soup trying to look gracious and so afraid that somebody's going to feed me tofu, you know? Jeez, I was terrified. So, and even more terrified that I might like it. So in walks this man. I mean, he didn't walk in. He bounded into the room. And, I mean, I went, oh, this might not be so bad after all. So that man and I clicked. His name was Gene Alcott, and he was an artist in Atlanta, and he was a friend of my sister's, and he didn't drive because he was legally blind, but he earned his living painting, and he got my attention. And I was just hot diggity dog, because I was really pretty convinced that I was going to be single all my life. And when I left that house that night, I knew I was not going to be single for the rest of my life. And that was October 4th, 1989. And on Valentine's Day, 1990, I married Gene Alcott. Well, I was one happy woman, you know? I mean, it was like, thank you, Jesus. And you know, what happened to me as a result of loving this man, you know those sponges you can buy that are all dried up and you put them in water and they grow and they get soft and you can use them? That was me. You know, I went from being this pretty rigid, pretty to just being just, I mean, I would go, they'd love to see me at work. I'd walk up to the IB cabinet and I'd go, anybody know what I'm looking for? And, you know, I mean, I have to admit, probably most of my blood was in my pelvis. But, you know, I was in love. So, and we didn't waste any time. You know, I met him in October. I married him in February. And I grew by leaps and bounds. Now, you talk about having to work the steps. Here I am, damn near 10 years sober. I'm 4 months short of being 10 years sober. An old maid, I moved in with an old maid, and we did two old maid. Like, oh, why are you doing that? I mean, wow, it was hard. You know, and I would go, so I changed my name, I changed where I worked, I changed where I lived. I changed, as far as I was concerned, I had changed every single thing in my life. And can't you see me telling him, I changed everything, and you changed nothing. So I started going to this 5:45 meeting because that way I could still be at home with him. And I was working weekends. I was working Saturdays and Sundays, and we had Monday through Friday off. And we were like Siamese twins. And there were some days that were so wonderful and some days that were so
heart.
I really thought that'd kill him some days. So I would go to AA meetings and I would just weep and I would say, am I ever going to be nice? And then I'll laugh. No, you aren't. Not you. Not you. Not going to be nice, baby. And so, you know, I went back to the steps because I'll tell you the truth. I was very powerless and my life was very unmanageable because I was so happy. And you know, it was just like those very early days of sobriety. I grew. Oh, God. I was wonderful. You know, except when I was crying, and so it was really difficult. So we've been married a year, and I was at work one day, and I thought, I can't remember the last time I had a period. And I thought, oh Jesus, I'm 40 years old and pregnant, and I wasn't. I was 40 years old and menopausal. Well, let me tell you, nobody said when you grow up and get sober, you too will have menopause. You know, and I'm sorry, but I don't hear it talked about in many meetings. You know, all of a sudden he was putting out body heat that was unbelievable. I'd wake up in the night and I'd say, get off my side of the bed. You know, I went out and I bought these insulated glasses because I would be so warm and I didn't want to have to get up and go all the way to the refrigerator and get something to drink while I cursed the son of a bitch for putting out all that body heat. I put pillows between us. You know? Why would it have been me who had the problem? And then something happened to my mouth. It moved so much faster than my brain ever thought about it. You know? I would be in the shower. Okay, now, and I've changed so that I'm working during the week now because he couldn't paint. He could not paint on Saturdays and Sundays. He had to paint Monday through Friday. That's what he learned at art school. Paint Monday through Friday and play on weekends. And so, you know, so I, the spiritual giant that I am, I made the changes. So, you know, so, but he also got up very early in the morning for no apparent reason. And so I would be in the shower, and he would open the shower curtain. You know, I had it just fixed, just real nice, and it was nice. And he'd say, boo-boo, I love you. And I would say, okay. You know? So I thought maybe hormones and more meetings. So I went to more meetings, and I took hormones, and he said, thank God. So he said, baby, I will pay for anything. As long as you stop being this way. And you know, and I love, oh God, I love him so much. And I wanted to be better. I did not want to be saying those things. I mean, I like I had Tourette's syndrome. So, and so, and you know, I mean, I couldn't figure it out. I was going to 90 meetings in 90 days and not getting better. I was reading the steps. I had my big book was about worn out. So hormones helped. And so in the event that your significant other starts to sweat at night, the steps will help, but hormones will too. So here we are. We've gotten to our second anniversary. And I'm thinking, oh, thank you, Jesus, we're on the downslide. You know, we had two really kind of hard years. And so he's having this art show. We got past our second anniversary. We didn't have a fight. It was wonderful. And he had an art show. Had an art opening. And so he had the opening, and every artist in town he chatted with, and people came, and it was a great show, and it was awesome. It was just wonderful, and I was so proud of him. And I called him Most Precious. Nobody had ever let me love them the way this man let me love him. So, and I called him Most Precious Angel, Love of My Life. And so, for short, it was Most Precious. And so, but he did have this real name also. And so he has this art show, and the next morning I get up and I'm going to work, and he's dancing around the house naked. And let me just talk about naked one minute. You know, I was trying. I knew that if I was serious about recovery, that there must be a way for me to stop being so unpleasant. And so he knew. I mean, now he was no saint. He was my most precious angel, but he was no saint. And so he knew he could push my buttons real early in the morning. And so I tricked him. Now, I was already a full-figured woman by this time. And so I get a little vision of me in a pair of pantyhose
And he was yak, yak, yak. I'm in the bathroom putting my makeup on, trying to go to work, and he's yak, yak, yak. And I start dancing, you know, and singing. And I cannot carry a tune in a bucket. And it would send him to the bed. He'd pull the covers up over his head, and he'd stop yak, yak, yak that way, you know? So, and I would make up these songs about my husband's crabby, my husband, you know, that kind of stuff. And so in the event that things are a little rough at your house, I highly recommend sending them someplace else or dancing naked through the house, and it will send them to their room. So you can stop fighting. You know, it really, you know, it's not exactly in the literature, but it's close. So, all right, so it's early in the morning. He's had this art opening, and I'm just thrilled. So I'm walking out the door, and he's standing there naked, and I said, "Oh, baby, I am so proud of you, and I love you." Now, I don't always say that as I walk out the door, because, you know, sometimes I said those other words. And he was standing there naked, so I went, "I'm so proud of you, baby." And so, you know, shook Mr. And off I go to work. Well, by noon, I was home, and he was dead. And I want you to know that it was absolutely one of the most difficult things that ever happened in my sobriety. And it's one of the things that has made me the most strong and the most soft and the most spiritual. He died very fast. He was killed in an accident. I went to the emergency room, and he was dead when I got to the emergency room. And by noon, I was home, and I was widowed. And, you know, I had been to all of those meetings, and I said to those people, "You know what? He won't do right." You know, and they'd say, "Well, you know, why don't you try working some steps?" And I worked so hard. And so he died on a Saturday morning, and I didn't go to a meeting on Saturday, but I went to a meeting on Sunday. Somebody from the program came and got me. And I went, and I'm sitting in this room, and it was all of the people who I really thought were special. And I said, "You won't believe what he's done this time." And, you know, I cursed God. You know, and I cursed God with every word I knew. And I knew a lot of them. I was so angry. I couldn't believe. I had worked so hard to get there. And I loved him so much. And I grew so much because there was somebody who allowed me, who was not afraid of the intensity of my love. And you all know what I'm talking about. You've been there. You know, where they just couldn't handle how much you loved. And it was so frightening. And that hole that I'd lived with, you know, all of those 42 years, it was all filled up, you know, and I was a complete woman, you know, and I knew that no matter what happened, I was going to be okay. And when he died, he didn't take it with him, you know, because it was something that had just worked, you know, so that I resent the hell out of having to go back. I didn't want to work the steps. I didn't want to be a spiritual giant. I wanted to die. You know, I just couldn't think of that anything could be that fair. You know, I mean, God is a, you know, an all right kind of God. You know, but I couldn't see that. So I went to meetings, and I sat in those meetings, and I just cried. You know, and I couldn't have cried in front of you before that. There wasn't anything in my life that needed crying about that you guys needed to see. And so I had to go, and I couldn't even say anything. I would just sit there and cry. People would come by, and they would hug me, and they would pat me, and I thought that was pretty disgusting, to tell you the truth. But, you know, because I did not want to be touched. I did not want to be loved. But you guys didn't care. You know, you just kept loving me, you kept supporting me. And people were really good. They didn't call on me much. Because, you know, what was I going to say? He's still dead, you know. And let me tell you, 4 years later, some bitch is still dead. But you know, he does what he can do today. So it sent me back to the basics. And I firmly believe that if I had not quit smoking, that if I had not been menopausal, if I had not been fired, if I had not done all those things. But you see, I also thought that when I had X number of years of sobriety, I would be a spiritual giant. When I had X number of dollars, I would be financially secure. When I had. You know, well, all of a sudden I had some years, I had some money. I had a broken heart. And what was I going to do now? You know, and I really think that I could have I probably could have killed myself. I probably could have done a lot of things. And instead, I probably just kept putting one foot in front of the other, you know, and said, look, God, you know, I need help like I never had help before. But you know what? I never could have accepted help without that kind of trauma. I was just too wood. You know, I mean, I needed that to get me to where I am. You know, and my hope for you is that you never ever have to do that, that you don't have to be as right as I was, you know? I mean, it was when I got married that I decided that I wanted to be happy and not right. I'd been right all my life, you know, and I didn't need to be right anymore. I wanted to be happy, and I was some days. And so, you know, and so a lot of stuff happened, and so I decided that I needed some changes, that if God was going to deal me these cards, I knew some card tricks. So I put my house up for sale, and I got rid of everything. My girlfriend Maggie says her interpretation was, if I couldn't have what I wanted, by God, I wanted nothing. And you know what? I gave it away. I gave away material things. I gave away this. I gave away that. I gave away. And what for some reason, I thought some of these things need to be saved, and I put them in storage. But before that, I bought this for sale sign. And so this is the way a heartbroken alcoholic woman sells her house. You go to Home Depot and you buy a sign that says, for sale by owner. And then there's a little place where you put your telephone number. So I put the sign in the front yard with no phone number on it. And so eventually people started coming up and knocking on the door. And I thought that was terribly rude. And I'd go to work and they'd say, well, did you sell your house? And I'd say, no, I haven't put my phone number up yet. And so, you know, I just had to do it kind of slowly. And so it just so happened that a woman from this same 5:45 meeting where I was going and weeping silently with dignity came to me and she said, I just finished real estate school and I would really like to list your house. Well, she was an alcoholic woman. She lived in my neighborhood. All right, you can sell my house. So so I turned it over to her, turned my will and my life over to the care of Isla. So she got a real for sale sign, and so the house, you know, the house sold, and I got rid of all my stuff, and because my sister, the sister, you know, with a birthday, I had a baby, and so she wasn't raising the baby right, and you know, I had a lot of experience. I had no children, so I was going to tell her how to raise this baby, and so, but you know, I'm coming back to the principles and thinking, you know, it's nowhere in the literature that says tell your sister how to raise your baby. So I walked into the nurse's station after a discussion with my sister and thought, I can't live in the same town with this woman and not try to raise her child. I've got to leave town. You know, it's just like with that old boy for nursing school. Can't do it, leave town. So I walked into the nurse's station and I said, I'm going to move to Santa Fe. And they said, that's very nice, Mary Alice. Is there a hospital in Santa Fe? I said, I don't know. If there's not a hospital, there's a you know, like a Waffle House. I can wait tables. I'll find something to do in Santa Fe. And it was because I'd read the book Santa Fe Rules the day before. You know, Santa Fe was on the brain. I can only retain for 24 hours. So I was moving to Santa Fe. So this nurse said, no, no, no. That's not the way to do it. The way you do it is you become a traveling nurse. And so I said, oh, okay. So ding, ding, that day. I'm alcoholic. Hello, I want to be a traveling nurse. And they said, fine. And so this gave me a way to have something to do, someplace to go, how to be, you know, a gypsy, I guess, and how to deal with my broken heart. You know, take my pain and go elsewhere. And so everything worked out. I went off to Europe and, you know, did the Europe deal and went to excellent English-speaking meetings and in countries where I didn't speak in English and met all kinds of funky people, and it was a really good adventure. And I came back, and I started working as a traveling nurse. And what a traveling nurse does, I take an assignment, I know ahead of time where it will be, what hours I'm going to work, what size the ER is, you know, all the details. They provide housing. If it didn't fit in my car, it didn't go with me. So what I learned was that I had already figured out that things weren't going to make me happy. I had a lot of things, had a dead husband, I wasn't happy. So things weren't going to make me happy, so I started getting rid of things. And it got so that if it didn't fit in my car, it didn't go with me. And I traveled around the United States and have been to all these different places and went to AA in every town. Now, I'm not saying that I think that this is the most serene or... it wasn't the best thing to do because I didn't have to get involved. But I couldn't get involved. You know, I couldn't be a part of. I had to protect my heart and my soul from whatever was out there. And so I could go in and I could do superficial, hello, how are you? Take their AA inventory very quickly because, you know, in Connecticut, I don't know if you guys have ever been to meetings in Connecticut, but they yak, yak, yak. They talk while the people are talking. The women have big hair. They chew their gum, kind of gum, and they shuffle, you know? And their tattoos weren't attractive. So I didn't much care for AA in Connecticut, but I went. You know, I went, and I stayed sober. You know, and I heard from other people different ways to work the steps, and da 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 da. So I'm still at this. You know, if I work these steps just right, by God, I'm going to be better. So I decided that what I needed to do was some serious sixth and seventh step work. I'd done fourth and fifth steps out the wazoo. People were tired of my fourth and fifth steps. So I'm going to do some sixth and seventh step work because that's how you get to be a spiritual giant. So I'm out in Albuquerque, and it's Indian country, and it's just, oh, God, just, you know, truly a spiritual place. And then I'm kind of getting into the, you know, back into the spiritual giant frame of mind. And I talked to this New Age dude who told, well, first I went to Canyon de Chelly, and I danced on the rim of the mountain, and I threw my character defects over into the canyon. And I was convinced. I was pretty good. It's not exactly what the literature says, but it comes close. So it didn't last long. And so I went back to work, you know, and encountered some people, and my character defects were back kind of fast. So my mother-in-law, who I've not talked about, but I worked really, really hard on my relationship with my mother-in-law. She was a woman, a very, very powerful woman in my life, who I couldn't stand. And I had to learn to love her. I knew that that was a lesson, that if I didn't learn that lesson, I was going to be in big-time trouble. And I was just hell-bent that I was going to learn my lessons and get on with life. So my mother-in-law is dying, and I'm going to give some comfort to my mother-in-law and put some mending to our relationship and just to be with her and be really grateful that we had our time together. And I'm coming back. I'm talking to this New Age dude on the airplane, and he says, no, 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 don't throw them over the canyon. Bury them. I said, oh, okay. So Maggie's coming out to Santa Fe, and I said, now, listen, Maggie, this is it. We're going to go to Chaco Canyon. It's this, one of the spiritual centers for the Navajos. We're going to bury our character defects. We are going to be spiritual giants. I said, bring a sterling silver spoon, you know, because that'll help. So Maggie says, okay. So Maggie gets on the plane, and Maggie comes out, and I said, come on, Maggie, we got to go. So we go, and they had this little sign. Now, Maggie will also tell you her side of the story tomorrow. But, so they had this little sign that said, do not enter. Well, that didn't mean Maggie and myself. You know, I mean, it looked like that's where we needed to go. So we go up, and it wasn't where we were supposed to be, and we buried our character defects, and we came down off the mountain, and we had a little encounter with the park ranger who wanted to fine us $25 for burying character defects on Indian land. And then she wouldn't give us a ride. You know, we'd already walked for hours. And so by the time we got off that mountain, my character defects were back big time. And I said, damn, Maggie, am I ever going to get better? Maggie said, I don't think so. So then, a little while later, I'm in this meeting in Washington, D.C., and this guy who's got about the same amount of time that I do is talking about sixth and seventh step work. And he's saying that he has hustled that step. He has turned it this way. He has turned it that way. He said, Nate, you hear what I'm saying? I have. He said, the step says, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. He said, nobody told me it was that easy. So in the event that you need to bury your character defects, I highly recommend Chaco Canyon. But, you know, it was like, duh. You know, this is the way I could humbly ask God to remove my character defects. I no longer have to trespass on Indian land. So, you know, it never ceases to amaze me how I want to complicate everything just to feel a little bit better. And so now I'm getting ready to start a new journey. You know, the last time I thought about going to school, I got married. And so I'm thinking about going to school. In my mind, I have this little sketch that I just bought a condo in North Tampa. So I've been homeless and unemployed for the past 4 years. And what I learned by being homeless and unemployed is that there's AA everywhere, and that I can stay sober by going to AA everywhere. That's a little bit lonely not being real connected, but that it worked for me. And that I don't need things. That having stuff is not going to make me better. Which is really kind of sad, because there was a time when I really did love stuff. And so, you know, I'm okay without having stuff. And I'm a little bit okay starting this new journey, because I bought a condo in North Tampa, and my stuff's been moved in, and I unpacked all that stuff that I had when I was married to Most Precious, and put it out, and it hurt my heart real bad, and it made me real happy at the same time. So I know that this is what I need to do. I need to go to Tampa, and I need to connect with the women in Tampa, and that I need to go to school, and that I need to be a part of a community again. Because that's how I get more better. And that's all I ever wanted, you know, was to be more better. And if I get more better than what I am right now, you guys better look out. You know, because, you know, I tell people when things happen, you know, when people don't do this right or don't do that right, and I go to AA and I tell everybody, you know, how this person didn't do this and this person, and I'm so disappointed in myself, because as a spiritual giant, you know, I'm a bitch one more time. So, you know, so I really know that when I go to Florida, that I will find a women's AA meeting. I'll probably go to a meeting with some of those old boys, too, but they're kind of stupid sometimes. But, you know, but I'm going to go to meetings, and I'm going to make a place for myself, and I'm going to be a part of the community, and I'm going to continue to grow. And I know that whatever God gives me, I'm going to be able to handle. And I haven't always believed that, and I haven't always liked what God gave me, you know, but I stayed sober, and I did it with your help, and I did it one day at a time. And I'm really, really grateful to have been here. Thank you.